Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is William T. Volman, whose latest book is Rising Up and Rising Down, Some Thoughts on Violence, Freedom, and Urgent Means. William T. Volman is a novelist with several books to his credit, including one set in San Francisco, The Royal Family, several other novels, short stories, essays, book-length essays. Right now I understand you're working on one about the region down below San Diego.
That's correct.
I want to talk about this book, Rising Up and Rising Down. In a general sense, it's about violence. What causes violence, the nature of violence in humans, and what it says about the human species and our rationalizations for it. And I want to put it also in the context of what we're looking at today, which is a second term of a Bush administration, the war in Iraq, and what might be happening. You began writing this book 23 years ago or 25 years ago?
It took me 23 years to write.
When you began writing it, you were pretty young.
I was, yeah.
How much revision did you do in the early stages of the book?
I did some, but the main process of writing was sort of agglomeration. I mean, I originally thought that it would be a very, very short book. And the heart of this book, the so-called moral calculus, I thought would be maybe three or four rules about violence. And instead, it's like a small phone book, unfortunately.
As I began reading the book, that term moral calculus came up virtually in the introduction. It struck me as being the two words that are central to any understanding of committing of violence and maybe to any understanding of how humans function. So let's start by talking about what is a moral calculus? What is the moral calculus and how does it play a role in what we do?
My hope was that I could create a series of rules regarding violence, which would be rigorous enough to be considered a calculus. And it might be possible to even manipulate some of these rules a little bit like algebraic symbols so that you could build other rules out of them. And in practice, I failed. However, I do believe that you can speak about violence in terms which are both general and useful, and that if you try to avoid boxing yourself in with too narrow a definition of things and assume that the people who are going to be reading this book or talking to you are reasonably giving and intelligent themselves, then I think you can actually get somewhere. So you don't need to exactly define what homeland is and exclude this and that and end up with something which is all cutting edge and no handle.
You say at one point in your book, there's a quote, which is sort of paraphrasing what you just said, which is, my aim in this book was to create a simple and practical moral calculus that would make it clear when it was acceptable to kill, how many people could be killed, etc. That's a pretty scary idea for somebody when you're starting, you're in your teens or early 20s, to even try to attempt.
It's an idea which a lot of people have thought about. One of the cases I mentioned in the unabridged version is Herman Kahn talking about nuclear deterrence. And he decided that basically a third or maybe even a half of a country's population would be an okay price to pay. Everybody has their own way of reckoning the stuff up. And it seems like, however scary it is, it's better that that we think about it instead of not thinking about it and letting somebody else make the computation.
There's a place where you talk about trying to find the floor of evil. At what point can no justification be made? Have you found that floor?
Absolutely. The Third Reich. All the reading that I've done over many, many years about Hitler and also about Stalin helped inspire this book. I just finished a collection of short stories called Europe Central, which are set in World War II, Germany, and Russia. And much of what I learned when I was writing Rising Up and Rising Down gets filtered into these fictional stories. But I do think that if you establish the ends of a continuum and then you try to find out what the middle is, then you can begin to see sort of what the moral equation might be.
So what is at the top end of it?
What would be most justified?
Yeah.
Nonviolence. However, that doesn't mean that nonviolence is necessarily sufficient, practical, or realistic. And in this book, I take exception with Gandhi's recommendation to the Jews after Kristallnacht. He thought that they should all march happily into the gas chambers. And I, frankly, am very skeptical that that would have done anything but encourage Hitler.
Well, yeah. I mean, if he doesn't care if you live or die, if they want to go on a hunger strike, well, great. Save some food.
Exactly. Martin Luther King talked about nonviolence as being a form of drama, and it really is. You have to have an audience, and the audience has to be willing to open its hearts to you. And if it isn't, then if you want to achieve your aims, then violence might be necessary. Gandhi said, well, that doesn't matter. Success is not important. But I don't think that that's the case. When it's a question of survival and imminent self-defense, that you have every right not to be a Gandhian. You have every right to be ruthlessly practical, to save yourself and to save others.
William T. Volman, let's bring into this the question whether the end justifies the means, because it seems to me that the phrase the end justifies the mean or does not is, in a sense, a rephrasing of the phrase moral calculus.
Yes, it is. You need to have a decent end and a decent means. One of the cases I consider is Julius Caesar. When he was fighting the Roman Civil War, he was one of the most merciful generals ever. But his end was to overthrow the Roman government, the Republic. And so it doesn't matter what a nice guy he might have been. He was still in the wrong. And you could also have a wonderful end. I mean, I think that most Marxist-Leninists have very, very noble ends. But I don't think that the gulag is such a great means to the end.
That's assuming that the gulag is a means to the end or taking the end in a different direction, and it's a different end entirely.
Absolutely. Trotsky always said that you had to give the revolution time. If you just waited a few more decades until all the class enemies had been processed, then you could talk about whether the revolution was too harsh. But I think that that was the direction that it moved in, and it lasted long enough for us to say that it wasn't justified.
Well, William T. Volman, as we look at this book, this whole work, in a sense what we're looking at is your thought processes over the years. So when you began the book, you had not done the things which later, I guess, helped define the process and try to come up with a conclusion. So when you began the book, you hadn't gone to Afghanistan. You hadn't gone to the magnetic North Pole. You haven't traveled through Cambodia and Burma, been a foreign correspondent, hung out with Saddam Hussein, which sounds pretty strange, and certainly wasn't in Bosnia, and that's because it was before 1994. By the end of it, where you are now, you're at a point where morality plays a much larger role than it did at the beginning. It seems to me that maybe that came about from watching people you know die.
Maybe partly. I think also that young people tend to be more goal-oriented, and I was more impatient, more sure I knew what I wanted and what was right. And one of the excuses that we find for our apathy as we get older is that everything should be a little bit more nuanced. Originally, these rules in the moral calculus were going to show me what I should do, and now maybe some of the rules give me excuses for not doing what I should do, but I try not to think that way. I wanted to be more of a man of action, let's say, than I turned out to be. I always wanted to make a difference politically, and this is really the best that I can do. Maybe someone who can act in the political arena better than I can read this book and be helped, but I know that I can't really do it.
So what do you walk away with it then? I mean, when you put it out to the world beyond saying, well, you read it, you explore, you figure it out, what does William Volman get out of it?
Well, I'm hoping that some Al-Qaeda terrorist, or for that matter, maybe our president, if he could read, might look through the moral calculus and wonder, let's see, can I make use of any of this? How might I square my own actions with my own theory? And if I can't square it, maybe I shouldn't do it.
When we're talking about violence and understanding the two sides of violence, the person being perpetrated upon and the violent person, we stop objectifying the other side. We take on a subjective look at the other side, and therefore we can't look at the other person as evil and us good. We have to kind of change that. Do people in America really care about doing that?
So far they haven't. It might take a few more September 11ths before they face up to the fact that they're going to have to. otherness in the world has a way of invading people who exclude it. Part of our problem right now is that we're still so interested in ourselves, and the people who have become and are becoming our enemies know so much more about us than we know about them. If we want to do better, we're going to have to know more about them.
But that requires, I think Simone de Beauvoir called it, going from the en soi, the objective, to the pour soi, the subjective. I mean, that's a real leap for people who were screaming, kill the terrorists.
That's right. I think it can happen. One thing that I found very encouraging after September 11th was that some of my friends who had never been anything but apolitical their entire lives suddenly wanted to search into their Lebanese family roots or find out who the Druze were or look at a Quran. And I thought, you know, this is so hopeful. I do think that we started basically from zero, and there is a little bit more of a feeling that these things do matter. Even the relatively high turnout for the elections, I think, shows that people are starting to face the fact that they can ignore politics, but politics won't necessarily ignore them.
But so, look at the outcome.
Well, maybe if a bunch of the young people who didn't vote get drafted, maybe in 4 years they'll vote. Maybe it'll take something else to get them to vote. I'm happy that more people are talking about it, that more people care. I think we have to have pretty low expectations so that we don't get disappointed.
The difficulty I see is when people watch propaganda machines like, say, Fox, which are specifically calculated to send out bells and whistles so you don't ask any questions. Well, then where do you start asking questions if you're not trained, if you don't understand that there are questions to be asked?
Well, that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. I hope that some people might read it and think, because the only other alternative is that sooner or later we will get ourselves in such a difficult position that reality will just come crashing through the walls as opposed to seeping through the walls.
William T. Volman, in a sub rosa beneath the radar way, violence, political violence, has come to America at various times, but on the surface it has not. We're living in cities that have never been under attack. Even in New York, it was one time, as opposed to Belgrade or looking at Berlin or looking at virtually any city outside the United States or outside of North America. Is it the cocoon that's keeping us this way?
I would think so. It seems to me that the cocoon is going to be breached again and again in our lifetime, and I would imagine that life in the U.S. will become increasingly like life in Israel. As we get into blood feuds with more and more people, they're going to come over here and try their luck in bumping some of us off. I can't see any way out of it. We're not going to be able to escape it.
William T. Volman, one of my friends said you're a very dark writer, and it colors all of your work. I mean, that makes me sense that you have a very pessimistic attitude, or you see it as just realistic.
Absolutely. It's not actually a very nice thing to say, but I did see something like September 11th coming, and I said so in this book before it was published, and I see other bad things coming, unfortunately. I don't take any pleasure in it.
When you say you saw it coming, what exactly did you see?
Well, I was in Iraq in 98, and I heard people talking about retaliation against us. I interviewed the head of the PULO, Patani Unification Liberation Organization, in southern Thailand, where some of this stuff is going on now. This was in 95. He said that shortly after the millennium, there would be a really big surprise for us. It was pretty clear that some things were going to happen and that a lot of people hated us, but nobody really seemed to care. And people now, I think, are hoping, a lot of the people probably who voted for Bush are hoping that if we just punish people indiscriminately enough, then we can go back to not worrying about it.
But that's not going to happen.
It doesn't seem either moral or practical to do it that way.
When I look at what happened in Fallujah, for instance, I keep thinking, if we're supposed to win the hearts and minds of this people, again, the moral calculus, when you weigh the two sides and you talk about destroying an entire city and killing thousands of civilians, the two sides of the scale, they're apples and oranges.
Absolutely. One of the things that I believe about a war is that for it to be just, it should aim at a just peace, which means somehow persuading the other side not to be combatants. That's clearly not happening. If I were going to compare Fallujah to anything, it would be Stalingrad. You know, here is an occupying army invading a city and engaging in guerrilla warfare with people who are probably going to inflict whatever casualties they can. If Fallujah gets reduced to rubble, then Stalingrad will just be played out over a larger scale. But it's not something we can win in the long term. And we have two choices. We can either stay and be more hated, or we can leave and people will be worse off because we've ruined the country. Seems to me the only thing we can really do that would be appropriate and moral would be to involve the United Nations and say, look, we're really sorry. What do you recommend that we do? If they have no recommendation, then we can say, all right, fine, you don't know what to do either, so shut up. If they do have some recommendation, if we follow it, then they take responsibility.
Well, I never understood from the beginning what a win would be given the context of the war. It struck me that nobody was asking the question, when do we win? Do we win if there's a democratically elected Islamist regime? What's a victory?
As far as I can see, you know, if we apply the indictments that were issued at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, then the president is probably a war criminal because the first count was conspiracy to wage aggressive war. And as far as I can see, the war was waged against a country which was not an immediate threat with phony reasons. So to me, this seems like a very, very serious breach.
And that would also mean that someone like Rumsfeld would as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And Ashcroft, I suppose, as an architect of torture.
And Gonzalez.
Yeah, it's not looking too good.
They can't control what's going on forever, and it has to come back to roost at some point, I would think.
I would think so.
A couple of other questions I have concerning what you may have discovered. One thing I got through in reading Rising Up and Rising Down, it kept coming back to me. We always talk about nature versus nurture. What's learned, what's in our environment versus what is human nature. Is it human nature to be violent and that we're fighting against it, or is that just what we've learned and maybe we can grow out of it? What do you think?
My assumption is that it's human nature because we see it as far back in history as we go. We see it. We see it today. And I see no reason why we won't see it tomorrow. We see it in animals. We see it in higher primates. You know, we see it in cats torturing mice. I think it's part of the game. So the only question is, how can we control, manage, and mitigate it? And the book, therefore, says we might as well talk about justified and unjustified violence, because if we said it was all unjustified, we would be completely unrealistic.
I'd interviewed Russell Banks talking about Liberia, where everything broke down. And then a couple months ago, talked with Lawrence Weschler about Bosnia, where people were justifying what happened in Srebrenica. And it amazes me that people don't talk about this kind of stuff. They avoid talking about the ways that violence is justified, rationalized away. It just astonishes me.
It is really surprising, and it's one of the things which is encouraging is that there does seem to be, in my experience, a finite number of justifications. I started hearing the same thing over and over again after several years, and that means I think that you can really categorize these things and decide which ones are evasions and which ones actually are justifications. So I think there is hope.
William T. Volman, changing the subject a little here, this book was written over the span of all of these years, and in the meantime, you wrote several novels. How do you relate your novels to the material in these books, do you think?
I guess people call me a character-driven novelist. I think that's accurate. That's probably my strength and my weakness. I would like to become a little bit better at plot. So I'm hoping and believing that studying the various moral dilemmas of these historical figures for Rising Up, Rising Down has benefited my ability to create a story. I'm pretty sure that my European short stories have benefited, and that was the first real work of fiction that I wrote after this. So I'll see if I can use some of these lessons for for other works of fiction as well.
What about in the middle of writing it, when you're writing a book called Argal, which is about Pocahontas? I mean, how does that come into focus?
I guess in the course of writing Rising Up and Rising Down, I came to believe more and more that it was important to judge people's and countries' violent acts, but at the same time that this act of judgment is incredibly difficult and complicated, and that actions get nuanced by cultural context and everything else. One of the neat things about writing these seven dreams books, such as Argal, is that I get to try to put myself in the head of a European and then in the head of a Native American and look at the same thing two different ways. It's pretty remarkable how often two competing cultures can misunderstand each other. That, of course, leads very naturally to violence.
You do say at some point in Rising Up and Rising Down, whenever violence defines my relationship to you, I am an apple, you are an orange.
That's unfortunately true, very depressingly true.
When you're working on a book that is not about that kind of culture clash, a book like Royal Family, it still comes out, but it's in a different way. Now, when you were writing on that, you actually hung out in the Tenderloin and lived for a while there among the homeless people, right?
I've spent, yeah, a bit of time there for sure.
And how does that living there in... It's not quite the same kind of violent equation, but how does that play into, say, the studies in Rising Up and Rising Down?
One thing that I have learned from my books about prostitutes and drug addicts and so forth is that people whom we often see as deficient somehow in their lives or as miserable aren't necessarily so. Everybody has his own form of normalcy. And everybody has his own dreams, his own way in which he thinks that things are right and good. The way that a prostitute lives in the Tenderloin is not as bad as most people think, and maybe not as good as she thinks. And that's probably true of the way we live, too. And if that's the case, then perhaps if we go and meet an Al-Qaeda member, we have to start with the presupposition that he may have a grain of truth in what he says, and probably he's not as great a guy as he thinks.
What I'm beginning to see is that the way this book plays out in your novels is that your novels kind of represent, on a fictional level, what you're doing in Rising Up and Rising Down.
I suppose so. I mean, unfortunately, the moral calculus doesn't have any great surprises in it. And maybe, fortunately, too, I'm not such an original thinker. And all I could do was try to organize whatever it was that I found, patterns that I dug out of experience and reading and so forth. But I guess the central good that I elevate in the moral calculus is the golden rule. And I think that the golden rule is at the heart of my fiction as well, that even if I can't always do unto others, I think it's important to try to understand where the other person is coming from. That's really what all my books are about.
William T. Volman, you are a very prolific writer. How much rewriting goes into any of your books?
Quite a lot. I try to make my books as good as they can be, and I work on them over and over for many years. Some of them are more stylistically polished than others. Rising Up, Rising Down is very uneven, because the case studies, the part of the book that deals with, you know, situations in war zones and so on and so forth, is based on things that I wrote in notebooks and for magazines and so forth. And I wanted to respect the immediacy of that, as opposed to modulating it and probably making it less an accurate representation. So the reportage stuff can't be up to the same stylistic level as the other stuff. But a book like Argal, for instance, went through a lot of iterations because I was trying to write in an Elizabethan voice, or Fathers and Crows, and I was trying to write in a French Jesuit voice in English. Yeah, the books go through quite a few drafts.
Yeah, the reason I mention that is because in terms of the amount of words that you write, a lot of people would say, well, there's a certain point where it almost feels like maybe it's kind of a channeled thing, however we define that, that it's kind of coming up from your unconscious, almost fully polished. And that's not the case, though.
No, it isn't. Actually, when I was younger, it seemed like the words came more easily. I could sort of feel them gushing out of my fingertips when I was working on the computer. And now it's often a matter of sort of chiseling the words. It's more effort than it used to be.
Do you do outlines or do you just see where it goes?
I do outlines for the Seven Dreams books because they are based on historical fact, and I want to make sure that I get all the details just right. But the other books don't need outlines.
I understand this one book, and I don't remember which one it is, where you kind of have in the middle of the book this long extended history lesson.
Sounds like all my books.
You have no problem in the middle of a book diverting the reader in a completely different direction for 100 pages or so.
No, it didn't bother Melville, so why should it bother me?
What kind of reading does William T. Volman do?
Well, I like a lot of the Library of America books. Actually, I just got that new three-volume set of the Isaac B. Singer short stories, and those are incredible. I'm having the greatest time with those. I like a lot of Eastern European fiction, Japanese, Icelandic classics, things like that.
What about the state of American fiction today?
Cormac McCarthy is a great writer.
And that's about it.
Yeah, I would say so. What do you think?
I interview writers. I'm going to back off from that. I feel that it's sort of my job when I'm doing that to try to not put any value judgments until the interview is over.
That sounds fair. The way I look at it, most of everything by definition is mediocre. So, therefore, at any given time, most of the things that we read and probably most of the things we write are going to be mediocre, too. All we can do is our best.
That's a little bit different from what Theodore Sturgeon said, which was 90%.
93%, yeah.
of everything
right.
is crap.
That's right.
Of science fiction
yeah.
and everything else.
That's right. I remember that. Sturgeon's rule, yeah.
When you were much younger, did you read a lot of science fiction?
I sure did. And I remember it so fondly, like the Cities in Flight tetralogy of James Blish.
Yeah.
I would love to read that again.
The 60s, 50s and 60s produced some great science fiction.
They did, yeah. That's right. I have a 6-year-old girl, and I've started telling her stories, and she loves it when I retell Le Guin's Earthsea trilogy to her. She hangs on every word. Tell me more about when the dragon did this and the dragon did that. I think that is such a wonderful trilogy. I mean, the ones afterward, I think, are not as good.
I know your first novel was kind of an alternate universe story. Do you ever think about getting back into science fiction?
Yeah, I think that would be fun. Maybe sometime I'll do it. But right now, I'm actually interested in working more on my visual art. I do a lot of artist books, poems mainly, that I hand color myself and sell in small quantities for high prices.
This is while you're still working on the book on the Imperial Valley?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Are you working on a novel now as well?
Yeah, I'm working on one of the Seven Dreams about Chief Joseph. And the very last of the Seven Dreams about the Hopi-Navajo land dispute is about half finished. I'm working on a book about poverty and a book about no theater, both nonfiction.
And when you're working on these, do you find it easy or hard to jump from one to the other?
Very easy.
Really? Why?
Yeah. You know, we all get blocked at one moment or another. So when I get blocked on one thing, rather than waste time, I move on to something else.
How about working in a field like film or theater?
I would do it if someone gave me enough money so that I would have complete control. One of the nice things about writing is that if you can convince your editor not to edit you, then you pretty much can do what you want. If you're directing and you have to get a producer and so on and so forth, then all of a sudden you become subject to unnatural strictures, I would say.
It's a collaborative effort, and you're kind of caught in the collaboration at that point.
I guess so. I guess my ego is too big to allow it.
Do you have an agent now, or did you? I know for years you avoided having an agent.
Yeah, I do have one now. I got one because I was having trouble selling the foreign rights to my stuff. I just didn't know how to do that, and she's been doing very well for me.
How formative in your life was the event in Bosnia where the jeep you were on hit a landmine and the two people you were with were killed?
It made me very, very grateful to be alive.
Did it change you on some deeper level, you think?
Well, you know, when I was 9 and she was 6, my little sister drowned. And I always felt guilty about that because I was supposed to be watching her. So even though my two colleagues died you know, violently, somehow to me that wasn't as formative an event. And I kind of feel that it could have been me, it could have been them, but we were there because we chose to be. And I think that it's the duty of a journalist to go in there and expect the worst and try to accept it with good grace. And so they died doing what they chose to do, and I think it's okay. I try not to feel too upset about it. It was very upsetting at the time, but I don't blame the people who killed them, and I feel, you know, equally sorry, maybe even more sorry for the people who were stuck in Mostar and Sarajevo and didn't choose to be there as we did.
So to that degree, you didn't feel the violent rage that you might have felt when your colleagues were killed? I mean, getting back a little bit to some of what goes on in this book, Rising Up and Rising Down, you didn't have that reaction.
No, I never did. Even when I found out later that the guys who killed them, you know, were, you know, trying to use their credit cards and so on and so forth. I mean, it's war. They got their booty. It seems like that's life. Let's move on.
You mentioned when we were off the air that you'd had a stroke in May.
Uh-huh, yeah, that's right.
What happened?
I was talking on the phone with a friend and felt a tingling in my left side, and then it went up to my tongue and I had trouble speaking or understanding. And after that, my reading and writing was seriously affected for a while. But now I seem to be more or less back to normal, except I have the occasional senior moment at 45, so I guess I just have to live with it.
You went to the hospital and it was defined as a stroke and all?
They were not sure what it was. They said, call it a stroke. Maybe it's a stroke. Maybe it's something else.
Do you sometimes feel as if there's a fog surrounding your brain now where it used to be clearer, or how does it feel?
Yeah, I sometimes feel that when I'm tired, and I didn't used to feel that way. But usually caffeine will cut through the fog.
Do you plan on writing any more giant philosophical tracts, or are you just going to kind of settle in on your visual art and your fiction now?
I might write some more long fiction, but Rising Up and Rising Down, in a way, was my life's work. I did the best that I could to address this issue, and I hope that it somehow helps people. I have no intention of doing something like that again. I may go back to war zones again if I think I can do some good for somebody, but I'm not going to write another long essay like that.
You've been listening to an interview with William T. Volman, whose latest book is Rising Up and Rising Down, Some Thoughts on Violence, Freedom, and Urgent Means, also the author of several novels. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.